This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. I know it doesn't feel much like April today, although we're warming back up a bit today. Stay with us. In the next half hour, we've got a look at the latest report on Virginia's job growth. We're also going to meet Dick Orange of Charlottesville, discovering his singing voice in his retirement. That's this week's episode of The Spark. Plus, where the universe's water comes from and how it ended up on Earth pouring through your tap. That's our island universe. Stick around for all that, but first, we took a two-part look at interfaith relationships in the Shenandoah Valley last week. In the first part, WMRA's Christopher Clymer Kurtz reports that over the years, many people and churches in Harrisonburg have reached out to show support for minority religious communities.
In 2002, at the request of the Islamic Association of the Shenandoah Valley, the Reverend Anne Reed Held found herself in a room with 13 representatives of the association and the FBI, which was looking for information about Saddam Hussein's supposed weapons of mass destruction.
They said, we need someone to vouch for us, that we're peace-loving, we're not terrorists.
When Held, who is now retired, came to Harrisonburg in 1990, at the start of her quarter-century pastorship at Trinity Presbyterian, local Muslims were already using her church's facilities for Friday prayers and later a Saturday school for children. This was little publicized until toward the end of the decade, when they issued a public invitation to a Ramadan celebration at the church, around the time of the war in Kosovo, which Held thinks could have been an influence when someone on the day of celebration called the church with a bomb threat. There was no bomb, but Held remembers that day.
Shook me up when it happened, but I mean, they were all kind of, people make these kind of threats, it's no big deal.
But in Harrisonburg, negative responses like the bomb threat are big deals because they have ended up strengthening feelings of interfaith support. One Islamic Association member remembers Trinity Presbyterian's support at the time of the bomb threat as steadfast. By the end of the 90s, the Muslim group was able to build and move into its own meeting place, which is still active. Dr. Hassan Ahmed heads the economics department at James Madison University. He has lived in Harrisonburg since the early 80s and was a founding member of the mosque.
When we built this place, we wanted to be really low-key because, you know, we're expecting to be low-key. And then comes 2001, and the entire attention was on us Muslims and local community.
After the 9/11 terror attacks, various church groups communicated concern. Some people even volunteered to spend the night at the mosque.
Really, the local support from local community was pretty strong. And I think that not only strengthened our community, it reflects on the local community, how friendly they were.
Fast forward a decade to 2012, when someone painted derogatory graffiti on the mosque. This was days after the attack on the U.S. diplomatic mission in Benghazi, Libya. Whether or not that was a factor, as before, Christians and the broader community responded.
It was a huge outpouring. That was very heartwarming, I think, for the Muslim community to know that, you know, we were in solidarity. You know, it was a hate crime. No, this is not what we're about, and we're glad you're here, and, you know, we're going to stand with you.
They talked about the tolerance and how really this did not reflect the views of the local community, and that is true. It was an isolated incident. It was not consistent with what we have experienced in this community.
Support from local churches for a minority religious community is not unique to the mosque. Rabbi Joe Blair serves both the Temple House of Israel in Stanton and the Bethel congregation in Harrisonburg. Blair tells of one instance from 5 or 6 years ago when anti-Semitic leaflets were left at the synagogue.
Churches and individuals came around and wound up collecting those and tossing them out and, you know, cleaning with and then let us know about it. And it's not the first time it's happened, but, you know, that was just an example of them knowing this was going to be disturbing and taking care of it, and then afterwards being kind enough to let us know that it was going on. They did what they could, and they were very supportive in that way, and I appreciated that immensely. Whether it meant a big deal to them or whether they thought it was a huge effort, it meant the world.
Not all churches participate in interfaith support.
In the Christian community, there certainly is a wide spectrum of people who are not comfortable in interfaith dialogue. Some are maybe putting their big toe into it. I've been blessed that the church I served always afforded opportunities for that.
In recent months, in the midst of tension and anti-Muslim backlash following the December shootings in San Bernardino and terrorist attacks in Europe, some church leaders sent a letter of solidarity to the mosque. And in January, the Interfaith Association held its meeting there. The organization has released a call for action, stating in part, "We intend to work together to stop fear of strangers from taking over the hearts of our institutions and members of our community." For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer Kurtz.
So that's a focus on how local religious groups support each other at an institutional level. Now, here's a look at one Harrisonburg family's personal embrace of two faith traditions.
Bill Goldberg and Lisa Shirk are not as unlikely a couple as one might think. Lisa is from Bluffton, Ohio, and can count the months she's not been affiliated with something directly Mennonite. Bill was raised Jewish in Baltimore. He now claims that religious heritage in a more secular sense.
I do embrace the culture, the history. I do identify as Jewish.
They met in Pittsburgh in 1995 when they were hired separately to co-teach an international negotiation summer course. By the end of the 5 weeks, Lisa says, all 100 of their students thought they were dating.
Which we were not.
But she says they did work well together.
Mennonites and Jews in the 1500s and onwards were both persecuted by Catholics and Protestants. There is a very long Jewish Mennonite history, and I know so many Mennonite Jewish couples, and I already knew those interfaith marriages when I met Bill, so it didn't feel unusual to me. I read mostly Jewish authors. Chaim Potok was my favorite author growing up. And I think a lot of Mennonite youth, we read Jewish literature because it's like a mainstream version of Mennonite.
Now they both work at the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding at Eastern Mennonite University, where they make their international and interfaith professional relationships work just like they make their interfaith marriage work.
The ethics and values of progressive Christianity are no different than the ethics and values of progressive Judaism. If you start focusing on doctrine and you must believe in the virgin birth and so forth, you know, then it doesn't work.
It depends upon where you put people in the religion. If relationships with people, if loving thy neighbor is the most important part, that's where you're going to focus.
It's a theme that also surfaced with the other people interviewed for this series. Dr. Hassan Ahmed of the Islamic Association of the Shenandoah Valley remembers a man who approached him following a post-9/11 engagement at a church. The man, his daughter and granddaughter in tow, told Ahmed,
"This is the first time I have met a Muslim in my life, and you don't really look anybody different than any of us in the sense he mentioned that your daily life is no different."
Anne Reed Held, retired pastor of Trinity Presbyterian Church.
You can be opposed to this or that, but you get to know the person as a person, then all of a sudden, oh. You know, and you stop lumping people and you stop stereotyping people.
But differences must also be recognized. Harrisonburg and Stanton Rabbi Joe Blair said that his congregants absolutely feel other. When Blair first began as rabbi more than a dozen years ago, some congregants pressured him not to wear his kippah as they feared it would single out him and therefore his congregation.
They were trying to fly under the radar.
Now, however, far fewer people share those feelings, in part because in a small community, being noticed is inevitable. That discomfort eventually dissipated because his kippah just
became the norm. So I think part of that disappeared in its own right.
Bill and Lisa attend Shalom Mennonite Church, where their family feels free to explore both of their heritages. Bill notes the Hebrew word in the church name. They wish, though, that they could experience that same sort of welcome of their multi-faith home at the synagogue, which does not allow mixed couples who are raising their children in both religions. When Bill and Lisa's daughter Miranda recently planned her bat mitzvah, they learned that they would not be able to hold the Jewish celebration at the synagogue because Miranda was also raised Christian, unless she would be converted to Judaism. Bill understands the synagogue and Rabbi Joe's position.
In thinking about it a lot more, he is the defender of the religion in Harrisonburg, and I understand his point of view, but it was just difficult to hear, you know, no, your daughter's not considered Jewish anymore.
So they created their own service, led by a Jewish community leader, and Miranda gave her bat mitzvah talk as a sermon to their church, gave the Shema, spoke Hebrew.
The comical side of this is, so in Judaism, when you're bat mitzvah, there's a specific Torah passage from the week you were born. And My vegetarian daughter's passage was about how to cleanly slaughter animals for sacrifice, which was, you know, what do we do with this? So we spoke to a good friend of ours who's a rabbi, and he said, you know what, pick a passage that means something to you, which was...
And the wolf shall dwell with the lamb.
Miranda's takeaway from her multi-faith family?
I guess just the appreciation of both religions, or of religion, and having two different families from completely different traditions.
Being a multi-faith family is something that makes life more rich. I think the same is true for Harrisonburg, that we are incredibly honored to have a mosque, a temple, and churches. These are treasures. This brings richness.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
Now, some news on Virginia's economy. New numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics show that Virginia added more jobs than any other state in the region last year. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope has a look at the numbers.
Over the course of the last year, Virginia added about 97,000 jobs. That's more jobs than any of the Commonwealth's neighbors and the fastest rate of growth in the region.
In terms of trends, Virginia has followed national averages. But Virginia has also outperformed national averages.
That's Carol Scotese, chairwoman of the economics department at Virginia Commonwealth University.
So, for example, employment growth nationwide has been about 2% over the last year, whereas in Virginia it's been 2.5%.
Luke Jude at the University of Virginia Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service says the growth has been focused in several key areas.
The largest sectors that are driving this are what they call professional and business services, so that is going to include a lot of kind of legal and government and tech type of jobs, leisure and hospitality, and education and health.
The city of Richmond has seen some of the strongest job growth, increasing about 4.3% over the last year. That mirrors a national trend benefiting university towns that have a strong knowledge-based economy. I'm Michael Pope.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wished I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. I met Dick Orange at a Virginia Festival of the Book event and somehow found out he was a late-blooming singer-slash-song stylist.
2:45, there's no one in the place except you and me.
Now in his 70s, Dick Orange is long retired from his official career as a school administrator and teacher. But the thing is, this guy has never not sung.
How lucky can one guy be? I kissed her and she kissed me.
I guess you could say as a kid I was not a very secure person. I was not a good student. I was not assertive. I was bullied. So in many respects, I was very inward and wasn't very confident, never had a lot of confidence. But put me in front of an audience, and it's a whole new thing. I mean, I just feel so comfortable, and it became more and more comfortable as it became more and more successful and got more and more feedback and more people who would come, who talk to me and let me know how much they liked it. So that's become a very comfortable part of my life.
You're good at it.
I think I am, you know, yeah. And I feel good about it. And it's become a great part of my life right now, especially since I've come to the Charlottesville.
Tell me quick, hey, love a kick in the head.
Dick Orange lived in New York State until he retired from teaching at age 58. He sang in a weekend party band and did some barbershop. After moving to Virginia, Dick stuck with barbershop for a decade or so, but then started getting into what he describes as the Sinatra style of singing, by which he means?
Crooning.
Crooning.
Basically, it means crooning to me. I feel that that's what I do best. I like to stay in that low, in that nice baritone range where I don't have to get up really too high, and I can get down fairly low, which is nice bass, rich bass tones, and so that's a crooning. That's crooning to me,
And what do you like about that? Why does that appeal now?
It's comfortable. I think the best word to say is that it's very comfortable. First of all, I enjoy the composers of that time. And the composers of that time, when you talk about Cole Porter and Irving Berlin and George Gershwin and Johnny Mercer and Johnny Burke and Sammy Kahn, all those wonderful composers, that music just lent to a crooning, to me, lent to crooning. And I grew up with those singing those songs. And I loved big band, and I loved Denny Goodman and Lionel Hampton. And I would constantly be listening to those records. And so that just everything, and just the songs were just so melodic and so well-written that it was just so easy to sing them.
So what'd you do with this? You moved to the Charlottesville area. You're a barbershopper. Now you're a crooner. Tell me about that transition.
Mona and I had a discussion back in 2008 when the economy went into the tank.
Mm-hmm.
And we said to each other, if we have to go back to work, what would we like to do? Well, I say, I got to stay with music. I'm not going to go back to teaching. And I think I can do that. And I said, well, I think I'd like to start a business. And the whole thing is all materializing to me and really market myself as a singer, as a DJ, as a because I have all the equipment. I have all the tools for it. So I did. I registered myself with the state of Virginia.
You are now a business.
I became Vocal Express LLC and started marketing myself and looking around for ways I could do this. And
when you say market yourself, what were you doing, standing on the street corner in Charlottesville with a sandwich board?
Well, that would have been interesting, but
yeah.
I think what I was doing, well, Mona and I are dancers, and we would go to all the dances with the big bands. And I noticed that there was some big band singers, and I said, you know, I love big bands, and maybe I can work my way in to one of these bands. Well, I was listening to Sentimental Journey, which is a very big band, and he's as a matter of fact, Ray Walston is the director of that band, and he's out in Stanton here, which is not that far away. And we've done some work in Stanton and JMU. And Dick Miller was the leader at that time. And the singer, the male singer they had, was unfortunately aging, getting older, and he was not well. And I gave my card to Dick Miller, and I said, you know, I said, I'm not rushing anybody, but I am a singer. If you'd like to, I'd like to audition with you sometimes. I'm at plenty of time. I'm not rushing anything, but I would love to be able to sing with this band. And we came back a few times to more dances, and he called me up to the dance stand during a dance one day. He said, would you like to do a number? And I said, sure.
So what'd you do?
So I did Pennies from Heaven, never forget. And we did the number, and that was fine. And okay, thank you very much. And that was the end of it until what happened was Clyde, the singer, unfortunately passed away, and I got a call. He said, would you like to come to our rehearsal? We have a rehearsal at such and such time. Would you like to come and sing with us? And that kind of started about 5 years ago, and I've been with him ever since.
So you didn't know it, but you were having an audition.
I was having an audition at that point.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting. You just, without batting an eye, get up there.
And I know the song. I know so many songs, Martha, that I knew the song very well. And then I have a very good friend of mine who I sang in the barbershop quartet with, started a band named Salute to Swing. And he said, I'd like you to sing with our band. And so I started singing with that band. And a member of the band was also singing with a band in Richmond, a Guy Lombardo-style band. And he said to the director of that band, I know you're looking for a male singer. And I said, I got one for you. And then now I'm singing with the Richmond band as well. So I'm singing with three big bands. And the piano player for Sentimental Journey is Bob Benetta, who's one of the best jazz pianists in the area. And we started to, I said, you know, Bob, can we do, you know, he said, I want to make a record, he said, because he loves Bill Evans and Tony Bennett. And he said, I would like to make a record of some of those songs. Would you like to do that with me? And I said, sure. Well, the record never came about, but my relationship with Bob Benetta did. And so we're in a combo together, and with a bass, piano, and drum, and we're working together a lot. And we now every first Thursday over at of the month over at the Tavern on the James, we do a dinner show and dance. So it's mushroomed. I'm learning. I've just been infiltrating myself with all of the greatest musicians in the Charlottesville Albemarle area.
I was listening to to what you have on your website mm-hmm. now, and I was thinking, this is not derivative. This is these songs are styled, not imitated. You're nodding your head, yes.
You know, people keep on telling me you sound just like Frank Sinatra, and that's in a way it's a compliment, and in a way I'm not trying to sound like Frank Sinatra. I'm Dick Orange, and I try to style my songs. I love Frank Sinatra, and I listen to him all the time. And now, especially since I'm singing his songs, I am maybe getting some of his style. And but this is, it's me singing it, and I really feel like I'm putting myself into Sinatra style records.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York.
You'll find pictures of and links to singer-song stylist Dick Orange in action on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
New York!
I'm Chanel Verani, and this is Our Island Universe. On a clear, dark night, when the moon is out, stare long enough, and you can begin teasing all kinds of information from just looking at it. Look through a pair of binoculars, and you see the moon is littered with craters. These impact craters we see on the moon, on Earth, and on other solar system bodies tell us that the early formation of the planets was very violent, when asteroids and comets literally rained down one after another after another. And the vast majority happened in the first few 100 million years in the solar system's history, during a period called the Heavy Bombardment. While violent for any burgeoning life at the time, these collisions are vital for Earth as we know it today. Why? Water and other hydrogen compounds was brought to Earth and other terrestrial planets by the impacts of water-bearing planetesimals that formed in the solar disk. As remarkable as it may seem, the water we drink, the air we breathe, were likely once part of planetesimals that formed well beyond the orbit of Mars. While much of the leftover material from planet formation that roamed the young solar system must have collided with planets, we see evidence of their existence way out in the Kuiper Belt, where icy bodies continue to roam. And of course, every night that we look up at the moon and see its cratered surface. I am Chanel Verani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at the website, too, and be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.